7 p.m. on Thursday, February 16, 2011. President, our Representative Lynn, Representative Sisna, Representative Miller, and myself, Representative Thompson. Co-chair, Representative Sadler, Vice Chair, Representative Gatto, and Member Representative Osterman are all excused from today's meeting, but I believe that Representative Co-chair Sadler is going to be on the phone. Before we start, please turn off your cell phones in this room, turning them to vibrate. They will still let them interfere with our equipment. In today's meeting, we'll be hearing House Joint Resolution 34 by Representative Herron, urging the United States Congress to fund all the facilities and vessels necessary for the United States Coast Guard to fulfill its Arctic mission, including icebreakers and an Arctic Coast Guard base. It is my intention to hear this resolution today and move it out of committee. We will also hear House Bill 316, sponsored by myself and Representative Sadler, an act relating to military zones in the state, relating to the development of housing in military facility zones, relating to the finance of projects in military facility zones, and providing for an effective date. It is also my intent to hear this bill and move it out of committee today. Our first order of business today is House Joint Resolution 34. Here to present House Joint Resolution 34 is the sponsor, Representative Herron. Please come to the table, place yourself on the record, and the floor is yours.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. For the record, Bob Herron, House District 38. Of course, in the packet, you have statements, the bill, and all the appropriate backup. But maybe a preface is that this is a result of work that Alaskans put into the Northern Waters Task Force. Not just the Alaskans that served on the task force, but the testimony and basically the concern of Alaskans throughout. Didn't matter if you're coastal, interior, north, south, east, west, is that our Coast Guard needs a Arctic capable icebreaker. Our Coast Guard needs a forward base that is closer to the Arctic than its current base at Kodiak. Now, Kodiak and is valuable to the United States. And so a forward base somewhere, maybe around Nome, maybe around Barrow, will only protect our interests as well as our nation's interests. So, you know, obviously that the Northern Waters Task Force found that there's increased Arctic activity, and we've all seen it, read about it, and some of us are actually directly exposed to it. So an icebreaker and an Arctic base will enable responsible development of resources, foster maritime commerce, safeguard Arctic residents and their ecosystems, and probably at the moment probably the most important aspects of icebreakers in an Arctic base is emergency and disaster preparedness and response, plus protecting our sovereignty. So Alaska is the Arctic nation of the United States, and there is an important resource that is out there in the Arctic, and it could be done responsibly, but we need the tools. We need our Coast Guard to have the tools. As you know, and you've heard, that there's other countries that are building icebreakers, countries that don't even have a border anywhere near the ice, near the Arctic. So in the packet, and there's information about marine transport and planning and infrastructure investments of the Northern Waters Task Force. The Lieutenant Governor is on record with testimony, and you know, with his advice, he gave us some ideas to incorporate into the resolution. Testimony from others are going to be outstanding individuals that are their service to our country was the Coast Guard. Of course, Captain Page, Admiral Admiral Garnett, Captain Lawson Brigham, Dr. Lawson Brigham. Zero fiscal note on this, and then if it's, it moves on to the committee of next committee of referral, is that it'll get a full fleshing in Representative Lynn's committee. Probably, I appreciate the two co-chairmen to considering this and maybe moving along, is that Senator Murkowski has invited us, legislators, and other Alaskans to attend a Homeland Security Budget Subcommittee hearing in D.C. on March 8th. So I would suggest that if the legislature passes this resolution, or at least there's a significant hearing process in this committee and the next committee referral, we can go back down to Washington, D.C. and say that Alaska is serious about supporting the efforts to fund an icebreaker or icebreakers and facilities to enhance our Coast Guard presence in the Arctic. And so lots of things have happened on the seas recently that I guess highlight, or I don't want to say showcase, but highlight the need for the Coast Guard to be an important aspect in Alaska's life. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm available for questions, but obviously we have some real talent that is going to provide key testimony.
Thank you, Representative Herron. Questions from the committee for the sponsor of HJR 34? Seeing none, you have some people that are lined up to speak. Are they signed up, or are they online? Where are we at?
I believe so. Of course, the Captain Page is in the room, and then I think that Dr. Brigham is online. I know at least them two.
Okay, then at this time I'd like to open up to public testimony. In the room to speak to the House today is Captain Ed Page, Executive Director of the Marine Exchange of Alaska. Captain, please place yourself on the record, tell us your affiliation, and we'll hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to talk. My name is Captain Ed Page. I'm Coast Guard retired officer, retired 11 years ago. I'm presently the Executive Director of the Marine Exchange of Alaska, which is here in Juneau, which provides a tracking system thanks to the support of the state legislature as well as the Coast Guard and the Maritime Ministry. I'd like to go back to my history with the Coast Guard. I retired some 11 years ago, so it's a little dated, but not too dated. And I did sail on the East Coast and the West Coast. But when I look back at the Coast Guard, my tenure, certainly the Coast Guard, since World War II, for that matter, has been providing ace-breaking support for the Great Lakes, and it still exists today. In fact, they're smart enough to build the vessel so it can't leave the Great Lakes. It's too big to get out the lock. So if we can make something too big to get out the Bering Straits, we might have it locked in ourselves. But it's a pretty clever move. But in any case, we have been providing, the Coast Guard has been providing that capability for many years. And they also provide ice breaking on the East Coast from New York Harbor to allow the oil barges coming down the river in the wintertime when the ice thickens, the rivers and what have you. So the Coast Guard has been in that line of work, and it has not really been in that line of work in Alaska. My last tour in the Coast Guard was as Chief of Marine Safety and Environmental Protection for Alaska Region. And I'll be honest with you, sir, the Arctic wasn't on our radar screen because nothing was happening. And since I left the Coast Guard, it started the Marine Exchange of Alaska, which has this vessel tracking system that is seeing what's happening throughout the state of Alaska. But certainly in the last several years, things have changed. And now we're starting to see cruise ships go through up across the top. We're seeing Chinese icebreakers snooping around our waters to try to figure out what kind of resource we have. We see many cargo ships going up to Red Dog to haul out zinc. We see tugs and barges and offshore supply vessels and others involved with the exploration efforts. And then we're seeing now tankers from Russia going, taking advantage of the Northern Sea Route and coming through the Bering Strait and continuing on in the Far East. So clearly the dynamics have changed, and there now is a need to have a U.S. presence as far as sovereignty, as far as emergency response and oversight, and to validate and compel compliance with the various safety and environmental regulations and respond when things go awry. And so to that end, I think that it's unfortunate that the icebreakers the Coast Guard has had are reaching the end of their lifespan at a time when we really need them up here, and certainly I'm preaching to people know it better than I do, but you know, the Arctic and the activities up there are more than just an Alaska issue. There's a national issue. It impacts our whole country. So the Coast Guard is clearly recognized in the world as a leader in maritime safety, environmental protection. But you have to be there to play, and they really don't have the capability to be involved. But I'm glad to see the state is throwing in their support, and I'm hoping they are anyway, promoting that the U.S. Provide the resources to the Coast Guard so they can have the presence that's required up there. And it basically sums up my comments, and appreciate the opportunity to briefly here.
Thank you, Mr. Page. Members of the committee for Captain Page? Questions? Captain Page, I was just curious what Coast Guard icebreakers are available at the present time right now if we had a problem up on the Arctic coast and had to get there?
Well, unless you cut some off the iceberg that's in the Great Lakes, which won't happen in Mackinac, or make a bigger lock, then really all you have is the Healy that's operational, that's suitable for that. And they have smaller icebreakers, 140-foot icebreakers on the East Coast, and some vessel, but that's the only capable vessel, the Healy, and it really wasn't designed as much an iceberg as it was as a research vessel with icebreaking capabilities. In the past, the Coast Guard had breakers that were somewhat designed to ensure that they could break ice to get into McMurdo Sound to provide the access for supply vessels for our International Ice Station down there, which I understand the Russians are doing this year because we don't have the resource to do so. While I'm sure that's an important mission, I think the Arctic and our own backyard is much more important, much more pressing, and the appropriate place to stage the icebreakers for the most part in the future. But there's only one icebreaker that really is suited to operate in that area, but it's really not a fully functioning icebreaker.
And where is it at the present time?
I believe it's in Seattle right now. My men would know exactly where it is.
Yes.
My staff would.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and if you'll indulge me, could I ask a few questions because I know so little about icebreakers?
Right ahead, Representative Miller.
I was privileged to be in another committee yesterday and got to see the video that they've made from the Healy and Renda adventure out to Nome, quite a successful adventure, and it was very inspiring. There was commentary made that the Healy is not, as you just pointed out, not necessarily an icebreaker, but it has those capabilities. What would a fully equipped, made for this mission icebreaker, what would its capabilities be?
Well, through the chair, first I have to admit, that's not my forte, it's not my strength. I've been when we've broken ice, but I've not really been on icebreakers, I can say, though, the limit I know is that some vessels designed, the sterns, what have you, are configured so you can back up in ice, and also displacement is large and the horsepower is greater. The Healy is limited in the horsepower and the design, so it doesn't have the same capabilities as the other Polar Star and Polar Sea breakers, so configured to go through thicker ice and higher classification. So probably somewhere along the lines of the legacy breakers, the Star and the Sea, which had substantially more horsepower, actually still do, they're just not, they're laid up at the moment, and their hull configuration is somewhat different and more suited.
Okay, and on that same line, if there was a problem today, we are in the middle of February, I imagine ice is pretty thick up there on the Arctic coast, there's some sort of problem that requires an icebreaker. And let's just say we happen to have one in Kodiak. How long does it take to get there?
Well, that's, again, not my forte, but because it really a lot depends on how thick the ice is, how much speed it can make. And I don't even know what the thickness of the ice at the moment is, but it certainly would be a good week for something to show up there.
All right.
And again, depending how much speed they can make and how thick the ice is.
Okay, so at this moment, even with an icebreaker in the ports that we have available, you're still looking at days before there could actually be
Absolutely.
A response, unless it was already there.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Representative Lynn?
Pretty much stole my thunder, but until a little after thunder here. What makes an icebreaker an icebreaker? You mentioned horsepower, ability to back up in the ice. I guess you get a running start to break the ice up front. How thick, a regular ship of the same size, I'm sure they can break ice about like that.
Sure.
But with the icebreakers that we currently have in the fleet, how thick of ice can they break effectively? And what were the super icebreaker one built for the mission? How thick of ice can they go through?
Right. Through the chair again, sir. May, hopefully you can answer ask those same questions to Admiral Garrett and Captain Brigham, because we really have a lot more experience. I can say I have limited knowledge, and there's a couple things that are fairly common in the design of icebreakers, and that certainly is the thickness of the hull and the design of the hull. So it's, many of these hulls are designed so they ride on top of the ice and they'll break the ice by the weight. Yes, sir. And the ballast systems can be used to move water from one end of the ship to another, from the stern to the bows. They actually put water on top of the vessel, make it heavier so it can break the ice. Also, the ability that you have to make sure the propellers and the steering gear are well protected, because the ice could break off propulsion and the steering systems are not configured so they could back up on ice or proceed through ice and well protected enough so the ice won't actually tear them apart. So there's thickness, design of the hull, and then and the power system, propulsion system, and then the rudder steering system are all different for a higher class icebreaker. And the bigger, the more displacement, the more power, all would lend itself to breaking more ice, obviously, or thicker ice.
Well, just to follow up on the West Coast, how thicker ice can the current fleet go through?
I believe 6 feet.
About 6 feet.
As far as the Healy is concerned, is my understanding. But I could be wrong, and I'm sure I'll be corrected by those who follow me, who have much more experience here.
Coming up online.
Yes, sir. Save for the guys who drove those boats.
Representative Cisna.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Just thinking about, and probably recently my experience has been more with the volunteer group, the Civil Air Patrol, and what I know in that group, what they talk about a lot is readiness and the need to be doing missions as often as possible, because the only way you're going to be able to take on some of the really difficult things that that the Coast Guard has done through the years, and I think any of us that have lived in Alaska for any time have seen that. I spent some time in Kodiak and was able to find out some of the really important missions that were done there. Is that you've got to have the equipment working. You've got to be out in it and doing difficult things in order to be ready for when the really huge catastrophes come and the Coast Guard comes through. It always comes through. You know, that's what I have heard and watched over and over again. So, this resolution, does it go far enough?
Well, I think it goes in the right direction, and it goes pretty far. I think you also have to balance it. What is the nature of the operations right now? While they're increasing, there's not a tremendous amount of traffic. Basically, we have 350 vessels went through the Bering Strait last year, based on what we saw with our tracking systems. So that's substantial, but something like the Panama Canal or Singapore Straits or even the Unimak Pass. But so part of the issue is to make sure that as the traffic grows that you're in pace with it and have the capabilities and mafia operations. And most of there's nothing going on up there right now in the dead of the winter. It's these shoulder seasons where things are happening. So I think that's the first thing you target is, do you have the capability? In some cases, they're shortchanged. I know the Coast Guard has been a considerable amount of effort, and I know I just saw an operation order just the other day that the Coast Guard plans as far as going up the Arctic this summer and bring up vessels and aircraft. And there are many challenges as far as where you hang the aircraft and some of the cold temperature issues that they've been facing, and where you even beach a vessel or dock a vessel, and whether a vessel can come across ice at all in some particular cases they really weren't designed to. And so they have to be very careful as far as where they keep their vessel, where they operate their vessels, and not encounter ice that's too thick. So clearly, they're trying the best with the resource they have. I think that this legislation, I'm very encouraged by looking at it, seeing that it's identified as a mission in the future, that you need more capabilities and you need icebreakers, and I think it's absolutely the right way to go. And I think that if we had better leadership boards, you know what this would look like in 10 years from now, but I think this is a pretty good shot at it, nevertheless.
Follow-up question, Representative Greg Sisnick.
Thank you very much. It is, however, may I ask, is this not actually a beginning?
Absolutely. To the chair again. Absolutely, it's a beginning. I think it's a very good beginning. I'm glad that Representative Heron brought it up and your panel's addressing it. I think it's very good to have, very important to have the state endorsement on supporting the Coast Guard. And, of course, the state of Alaska has been, my experience, been a raving fan of the Coast Guard for many years, and I'm glad to see they continue to do so.
Thank you very much.
Representative Lynn.
Is there room on an icebreaker or a helipad? I can see where a helicopter would be a very handy thing to have on to scout up ahead, you know, where the ship is going and run missions back and forth, rescue, you know, et cetera.
To the chair again, absolutely. And, of course, that's some of the genesis of the red helicopters, because they first came up with that idea when they started flying helicopters off the icebreakers and realized if a white helicopter didn't stand up very well against the ice. And so that's why the breakers and the helicopters are red. But they always sail with a helicopter. I believe actually have the capability to carry two. And they're important for scouting the ice to find the best leads and best path to take. And also as a mission, you know, they can do a lot more with a helicopter. Rescue certainly can be best be done fastest through the use of a helicopter. So that's kind of standard piece of equipment that they're going to hang on those things. Sir.
Further questions of Captain Page? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, sir.
Next, I think we'll turn to Admiral Jeffrey Garrett. Admiral Garrett, are you online?
Yes, sir, I am.
Yes, go ahead and place yourself and your affiliation on the record, and we'll listen to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. I'm Rear Admiral Jeffrey Garrett, U.S. Coast Guard retired. I'm currently an independent maritime affairs consultant, but I spent much of my Coast Guard career serving in the icebreaker fleet and was most recently just up in Nome as part of the operation with the Rinda and the Healy. So anyway, I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to participate in today's hearing. As a Coast Guard officer, as I mentioned, I spent much of my career in the nation's multi-mission polar icebreaker fleet, operating in both polar regions, but particularly in Arctic Alaska. And during my career, most of these operations were limited to defense support and the support of science programs sponsored by other agencies. But as the committee well knows, transformational changes occurring in the Arctic now extensively affect most of the Coast Guard's statutory responsibilities. And I think the Coast Guard in the past few years has made a valiant effort to project an Arctic presence, deploying cutters, boats, aircraft, and specialized teams to the Arctic to test equipment capabilities and procedures and to enhance Arctic operational experience. But as the resolution in question here most clearly states, the most critical and effective capability that the Coast Guard could apply to its increasing Arctic responsibilities is largely missing from the scene today. At a time of growing need, our polar icebreaker capabilities are steadily drifting into obsolescence. The consequences of long-term disinvestment in our icebreaker fleet are beginning to emerge. The Coast Guard has been unable to deploy an icebreaker for Arctic multi-mission purposes for over 2 years, and planned science missions for the USCGC Polar Sea have had to be canceled. The nation had no icebreaker available to provide the critical annual resupply of U.S. bases in Antarctica this year, forcing reliance on an expensive short-term charter of a Russian vessel. In addition, the need to ensure that the city of Nome received fuel supplies last month was accomplished by the icebreaker Healy in a valiant effort, and I was privileged to be a part of that. But while successful, it was accomplished only at the cost of extending Healy's lengthy Arctic deployment and disrupting planned maintenance and operations later this coming year. I think Alaskans clearly understand what's happening in the Arctic today, and I'm happy to see that the needs for adequate Arctic resources cogently summarized in HJR 34, as well as the resolution's strong call for the federal government to provide the U.S. Coast Guard with the capabilities, particularly polar icebreakers, to meet our national needs in the Arctic. The fact that the President's 2013 budget contains some initial funding to begin an icebreaker acquisition is an encouraging sign. that this important action must move forward quickly, and we must restore Polar Star and Polar Sea to full operational capability in the interim. There's really no substitute for having the right tools to meet the challenging of a transforming Arctic. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Questions from the committee for Admiral Garrett? Seeing none, I thank you very much, Admiral Garrett, for your testimony. Next, we are going to go to Professor Brigham. He's at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. Professor, are you online?
I am, sir.
Yes, go ahead and place yourself on the record, and we'll hear your testimony.
Yes, I'm Dr. Lawson Brigham, a professor at University of Alaska Fairbanks. But my first life, I was a skipper of the Polar Sea and a Coast Guard officer at the same time of Admiral Garrett and so I'm prepared to give you a testimony, sir.
Pardon, I didn't
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the members. I submitted a letter to Representative Herron, which was a couple of technical issues regarding HJR 34, and I'll just review those quickly. The first one really is a protocol issue. The resolution was in draft form being sent to the senior Arctic officials of the Arctic states, when really they are really just the administrative officers of the Arctic Council, although some are at ambassador level, and not our country's senior Arctic official, though. And really, I recommend that the resolution be sent to our Secretary of State, of course, who is on there, but also the foreign ministers of the Arctic states, who are really and truly the Arctic ministers, and they'll pass them down, this resolution, clearly down to the senior Arctic officials. So it's really a protocol issue. The second issue I had really is more substantive and important. The last passage in the resolution has further resolved that the Alaska State Legislature urges the United States and Congress and administration to consider all options to finance icebreakers. Talks about icebreaker fees, options for lease, giving our icebreakers currently to the private sector. I highly recommend that the legislature remove that section. I am concerned about the issue of fees, even the reference to fees, because user fees, or in this case called icebreaker escort fees, really have no place in the operation of the Coast Guard for this operation. And I would say that financing of icebreakers and the sense of this resolution is truly that the Congress administration fully finance the Coast Guard as it would the Navy or the Air Force, and not lease ships for use by the Coast Guard. So I believe that that resolution is really stepping outside the bounds of what you might want to recommend, and not in the same sense as the whole of the resolution, which is really that the Congress administration should fund appropriately icebreakers and a base for the U.S. Coast Guard. I would be happy to answer any questions about icebreaking to add to what my two colleagues have already spoken about. Thank you.
Questions of Professor Law? Brigham. Representative Miller has a question. Professor?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Professor, thank you so much for dedicating some of your time to us today. Within the body of the resolution, page 2, line 1, it indicates that whereas ice cover in the Arctic is now at historic lows and multi-year ice is decreasing. So how quickly is that going to have an effect on how many icebreakers we may or may not need, and is that exclusively in the Arctic, or is that also in the Bering, the Chukchi, et cetera, the other bodies of water between ourselves and Asia?
I think that's an excellent question. The ice is certainly decreasing. In fact, in several decades, no doubt the multi-year ice will disappear in the Arctic, which makes it, in a sense, easier for navigation. But the whole retreat of sea ice and the thinning of ice and the less extent has actually drawn traffic and opened sea lanes, so there'll be more traffic, and therefore there would be more responsibility for the Coast Guard for presence, for law enforcement, for security reasons, even for more science. So people might think that because of the decrease in ice, we have less need for icebreakers, but it really is just the opposite because of man's greater use of the whole of the Arctic Ocean. We know on the Russian side all of that is taking place, and partly it's related to natural resource development, but partly it's the opening of the season and the retreat of sea ice, which is much longer season of navigation in that part of the Arctic. So, in effect, I think the words in the resolution are right on target, that the opening of the sea lanes actually requires more presence, more capability for the Coast Guard.
Mm-hmm. Follow up, Representative Miller.
Thank you. That is about what I had expected. So does this mean that perhaps we can get by with a less than fully equipped icebreaker in the near future? I'm not trying to debunk this at all. I really think that we need several of them, but I want to make sure that we design the right ones for the right conditions.
Yeah, I think you're really asking whether we can have year-round capability to operate. And still the ice in the Arctic Ocean is quite thick, and of course, as everyone knows in Alaska, is fully ice covered from the Bering Sea all the way across the Arctic Ocean. So the need for polar class capability, the current polar class ships, is in fact, if industry can operate year round, or in the shoulder seasons, in the fall and the spring, even more necessary than it has been in recent decades past. So the Healy, while very exceptionally capable ship and with lots of tonnage and fair horsepower, really might have challenges operating deep into the season, even into the winter season. So if we have exploration offshore, if we have operations in the wintertime, and there will be operations at least on the Russian side and ships through Bering Strait perhaps in the winter, within the decade, we will have to have capability commensurate to respond to a variety of issues that could occur.
Thank you, Professor. Representative Glenn.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, sir. How long would it take, Dave, you got authorization to build an icebreaker and the money to do it before you could launch it?
Well, that's a highly technical acquisition question, but I think it's a good one, and I think it's been reported that anywhere from 8 to 10 years it might take. It's hard to believe that, but with our budget process the way it is in Washington, it could very well be that long to get an actual ship in operation. To build it probably would still take anywhere in America 2, 3, 4 years to physically build. So the budget process added on and previous to that, the commencement of building and the award of the contract. We're talking about a long, long period of time, unfortunately.
Thank you very much. I hope we build in America and not China.
I don't think the Congress will allow that.
Depends on the Congress we elect.
Is there further questions of Professor Brigham? Representative Herron is back up at the table. He does have a question, Professor.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I guess one comment on Dr. Brigham's suggestion on protocol.
We have that.
Yeah, I fully support it, but I guess that I appreciate Dr. Brigham sharing his concern with the further resolved about leasing, and of course, Dr. Brigham was at that high-profile summit that was last summer in Girdwood, and this was language that was offered for everybody's consideration. And so, Mr. Chairman, I could work with this committee and the following committee to come up with options for you to consider on maybe improving that resolve. But I guess what I'd like to have, because Dr. Brigham, you know, being on one of the Coast Guards that's dry docked, Dr. Brigham, there is, on page 3, there are some whereases where they talk about how the Polar Star is in repair, and the official expectation is there in the whereas. Is that, in your opinion, is that feasible or accurate?
You mean bringing the ship back into service?
And the length of service.
And the length of service. My guess is it's, on target and accurate. The challenge is to appropriate enough money to keep the ships in the short run, but no one is talking in the long run because we hope that a full acquisition process will take place. So, of course, all of the costs of these are quite extraordinary, even to extend the lives of these ships. And so it's a challenging budget issue, and I think it's one that has to be meshed with the acquisition process, and finally we see some words in the current budget that might allow that to happen. So they're both tied together, clearly, the refurbishment of the ships and acquisition of a new ship, and they should be tightly tied together.
So, Mr. Chairman, one follow-up question. Dr. Brennan, is basically a two-part political policy inquiry to you, your opinion. Is, of course, what the Healy did for the community in Nome is just in an overarching way is probably very valuable for Alaska in getting an icebreaker for the Coast Guard. Given that, plus our friends in China, they're building another world-class icebreaker. Are these two events enough to convince not only our administration, but the Navy that maybe it's time to invest in icebreakers?
Well, I hope so. I think clearly having a single ship, but that single ship, the Healy, doing a great job and showing actually the high readiness of the Coast Guard to do the job. The only problem, the challenge the Coast Guard has is lack of assets. In this case, we have quality people, we have the readiness, so we can do all of this, but I think other events in the whole of the Arctic also require these ships, maybe not as visible as the Chinese building an icebreaker research ship or the Nome operation, just the general offshore development off the coast of the U.S. Maritime Arctic is enough to say we have to have presence, and presence also in the ice, and maybe presence in the shallow waters around Alaska also. Currently, the buoy tender fleet has modest, if not light, icebreaking capabilities, but I think even that capability is not rigorous enough to operate in shallow waters. You understand that the Healy and the tanker could not, and Admiral Garrett understands quite clearly because he was there, could not quite get close enough to the beach, and that's because both ships, at least the Healy, drew a fair amount of water. So I think shallow draft icebreaking assets, maybe newer buoy tenders that could do multi-mission work, would also be necessary, not just a large single icebreaker.
So, Mr. Chairman, just
go right ahead, Representative Aaron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Lawson, I had the opportunity to listen to you make a presentation on the challenges facing Alaska and the Arctic, and you said that the U.S. Navy had just ordered 51 warships that are needed for replacement and for our national security, and each warship is a pop of $500 million, and I remember saying, why don't we just order 49 and build one icebreaker? So given that preface, do you think that if the Russians and the Chinese are building big toys, do you think the United States should build one too?
Well, of course, you're preaching to the choir here. Yes, of course. I think that, of course, this budget issue of the littoral combat ships and how many we have for the United States is, of course, driven by the Navy's budget. But they do cost, $500 million apiece, and two of them could equate to an icebreaker. Of course, that's not necessarily how Washington works, but clearly there is a need for our presence, and I would also argue that because because of our extraordinary national investment in Antarctica and this readiness question, having the nation's largest polar ice breakers work at both ends of the world, summertime in Antarctica, of course mostly summertime, but be available for wintertime work in the Arctic, is hugely important. So while we're interested in this resolution for the Arctic, we also should look at America's investment in both polar regions and America's presence at both polar regions, and that presence is really, in the maritime world, the nation's icebreaker capability.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions by the committee of Professor Brigham? Seeing none, Professor, I thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And is there anybody else online or in the audience that would like to testify to House Joint Resolution 34? Seeing none, we're going to take a brief at ease while we try to get our quorum back together so we can work on the amendment and on passage of the resolution. And we will start testimony on the next piece of legislation that we're addressing, and when we get our quorum back, we will probably take a brief at ease, go back, and pass the House Joint Resolution out of committee. So our next order of business is House Bill 316. This is sponsored by myself and co-sponsored by co-chair Representative Sadler. It's an act relating to military zones in the state, relating to the development of housing and military facility zones, relating to financing of projects in military facility zones, and providing for an effective date. We have in the room today, we have Mr. Dale Nash, Chief Executive Officer of Alaska Aerospace Corporation, and Mr. McHugh Pierre is here also, Deputy Commissioner of Military and Veterans Affairs. Both of these gentlemen will be available for questions on House Bill 316. Here to present the bill is my aide, Thomas Studler. Mr. Studler, please come to take the table, give us your name for the record, and begin the presentation.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Thomas Studler, and I serve on Representative Thompson's staff. And I'd like to thank the committee today for the opportunity to present this bill to you. As you heard from the chair, HB 316 is an act relating to military facility zones within the state. What this bill does is it gives statutory authority to the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to establish military facility zones within the state of Alaska. These zones are designated in close proximity to military bases or facilities where industrial or economic development will directly enhance the military's ability to fulfill its mission. Military facility zones are successfully employed in other states as vehicles to obtain and administer funds for business development, specifically relating to military activities. Funding for such zones in Alaska may be available from Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority and or the Alaska Housing and Finance Corporation, or from federal new market tax credits, federal, state, or local private and public funding sources, credit or guarantee programs that can be made available directly to municipalities and boroughs that are working on specifically approved projects within these military facility zones. Military facility zones create opportunities for significant benefits to Alaska and to the nation. They will enhance economic activity near military installations and thereby facilitate economic growth and development within the state, especially where local governments are working in close partnership with their military counterparts. The zones promote expansion of infrastructure to benefit both military and our civilian objectives, such as civil defense, homeland security, and emergency response. They will enhance the nation's military capabilities by helping bases operate more effectively and efficiently. Finally, military facility zones in Alaska will clearly demonstrate the state's continuing and substantive support for our armed services and help defend against the negative impacts on Alaska's regional economies and military communities that might occur should Congress choose to implement the Federal Base Realignment and Closure Act in the near future. With that, sir, if there are any questions, I do know there are people that are either present or online to testify to answer specific questions about this bill today, sir.
Any questions from the committee for Mr. Studler?
I was
Representative Miller.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do apologize. I feel a little embarrassed that I have to ask this question, but I'm sure somewhere
There is a clear definition of exactly what constitutes a military facility zone. I just don't fully understand what it is, how it functions, what goes on in there, what doesn't, how is it granted, how is it created, how is it defined. You did say one thing that I did pick up on, that it's near a military base, but that's kind of a vague word. How near is near? 1,000 miles, 50 miles, 100 feet? Whatever you can give me would be helpful.
And Mr. Studley, we do have experts here in the room that can help dig into that a little further if you want them to do it.
I can do that. Yes, that would probably be better if they explain that, because they've actually been involved with them in other states and other locations with that. So,
thank you. Okay. I hate to interrupt our procedures, but I'm going to roll back up our area here to get back to House Joint Resolution 34, as we do have a quorum present again. Since we had closed public testimony on House Joint Resolution 34, I would like to offer Amendment A1 at this time to be referred to as Amendment 1. You all have a copy of that. You heard Mr. Brigham speak to this already. Without objection, Amendment 1, I would like to move Amendment 1 before the committee for discussion.
Object for discussion.
Okay. You heard Mr. Brigham's testimony already on this. This is more or less a change in the procedure to make it the proper protocol as to who gets sent this resolution. Any questions on the amendment?
I'll move my
question. You removed your objection. Any other objections? Then we will adopt amendment number 1. Is there any further now with the amended resolution? We're back to the committee. Any further?
Chair, would you entertain the motion?
Yes, I would. There's the...
Okay, I'd like to... If I stop coughing long enough, I'd like to move the HGR 34 version 27-LS1303-A as amended, with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note from this committee.
Is there any objection? Okay, then we have moved HJR 34 as amended from committee, and now we will, while we're still signing, but we'll go ahead with our next order of business that we have started into, House Bill 316. And at this time, I'd like to call up Mr. Dale Nash. If you'd please place yourself on the record and your...
Certainly, Mr. Chairman.
Affiliations, we will.
Dale Nash, Chief Executive Officer, Alaska Aerospace Corporation. I think we may have also Vice President of Lockheed Martin on board.
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Jeff Trojan from Washington, D.C.
Jeff Trone. He is the, in some of the questions, specific to other states, I can address those, but he is he's very good at it. Jeff Trone is the Vice President of Economic Development for Lockheed Martin Corporation, the largest defense contractor in the United States. As a matter of fact, the largest defense contractor in the world. And this bill, as a matter of fact, came about working closely with Lockheed Martin, talking about ways to improve the state's position for the military customers and for the military support industry, the aerospace industry, where several states have adopted very similar legislation to this, not to be confused with other economic development that is out there, but economic facility zones are specifically targeted in support of military installations, where states can step up and help either facilitate a reduction of costs for the military to make it more cost effective. In essence, we all know we're competing, especially as budgets decline, in what can be the most cost effective. And as legislators, you all have to wrestle with this yourselves. Where do you get the most bang for your buck? There's obviously strategic locations and things like that, but where do states help partner with the military and with the military industrial base, being the Lockheed's, the Northrop's, the Boeing's, the Alaska Aerospace is to keep the costs down for everyone. Almost all states have economic development zones, but these are very specific in support of military, so you don't get confused. All the schools, all the malls, all the developments aren't very important. They're essential to our society. But to focus clearly on those things that will help us, help our military, help our state, and in essence help compete as Alaska Incorporated as we go to it. A couple of things we point out. The intent is to be close to military bases, typically within a reasonable driving distance. You want to avoid just saying adjacent to or butt against, because some military bases actually want a buffer zone. But this enables things like housing that a military base may have to pay for and historically had paid for in the past. Many, many states have helped enable whether it's a base or a fort, setting up low-cost housing that the military does not have to put the capital investment in. They can give the housing allowance for the military, and it works in the community. So you can set up things like that. If you typically, every state I've been in, you have a large industrial base outside your military installations. In fact, I was a little surprised at how strong Alaska is with the military and how little we had in the form of the aerospace support companies. Almost all of those, you'll see the Lockheed building, the Raytheon building, whoever building is outside of the base, and many of those have been set up by something like a military facility zone where you can help move that supplier base and with it more jobs, and with it the ability for the military to support their equipment and not have to ship something back to a depot halfway across the United States. It could certainly help us as we look to grow facilities on the Kodiak Launch Complex in support of NASA or military. It is very effectively used by many. This or similar approaches are very effectively utilized by some states who look forward to the BRAC process rather than dread the BRAC process, because you will go into their war room. I haven't seen it, but I understand the mayor of Huntsville, Alabama, has his priority. He's looking forward to that BRAC process so he can bring missions in, not lose it. So this is not only to play good defense, but hopefully be able to set us up to begin to play some good offense. And as we look forward, say, okay, we may have had the F-16s move from Mileson, but what else might make sense to bring in there? What could we bring in there? What can we bring here in within the state to support the Coast Guard, to support the Air Force, to support the Army? What are those things we can do to take off the military's plate? Because all other states are doing that, maybe not all. The smart states are doing that to say, your mission is planes, your mission are the military, whether it's the Army or the Navy. You need to worry about ships, planes, troops. You don't need to worry about recreation centers, your version of the Walmart on base, your version of the theater or the entertainment. All of those have been great things that have been here, but with them comes a cost every time. So if we can remove more of those costs or share more of those costs with the military through the utilization of this bill, it not only helps us to play good defense, but hopefully we can shift into good offense and start to look at what other missions we might be able to attract in here, including, and Mr. Trone can talk more about this, including the ability to utilize and co-lease space within existing bases that may be idle. So now DOD is not having to pay for the utilities or the rent or the upkeep on some of these things, and that's been done other places. And this is just enabling legislation, not with a cost to it, but this is enabling legislation to really get all of these things set up, and it can take a different view, whether it's Coast Guard, whether it's Air Force, whether it's Army, whether it's Fairbanks, whether it's Anchorage, whether it's Juneau or Sitka or Kodiak. it is the enabling legislation that lets you get very specific in the areas and very specific with customers who may want to come here. Thank you.
Questions to Mr. Nash? Representative Sisna.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My question is, in this legislation, do you think that that there are ways that could be improved upon in paying attention to exactly what the state is like? And this state is a state that has huge, vast regions that are with little communities hundreds of miles apart, small communities. And what I think is really fascinating is that the Homeland Security in the state of Alaska has done a really good job of helping those local communities to figure out how to identify where they need to be strengthened. And to then sort of commit themselves to be able to be there as backup, but with the local people really understanding their own strengths and where they need to work on that. And the position of our state relative to all other states and relative to all the land masses around, we're critical. We are in an extraordinarily critical position, and I often think that in terms of the security picture, and I do have issues with TSA, it's true, but at the same time, I think our state needs to be looking out at our borders and making positive that we're strong. And that means really paying attention to maybe having some of these military sites in places where we're thinking strategically and using the local communities to be part of planning ahead, because eventually, you know, we're not in a stagnant world, and populations are growing, and there's going to be disagreements coming up about land masses and who deserves them the most, don't you think?
I think I'll hold that one for a reply from our Deputy Commissioner McHugh Pierre. Any further questions of Mr. Nash? Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very quickly, within the definition that you gave was a little broad, could you actually establish an economic zone or even a military facility zone on a military base, on military reservation territory?
The other states have utilized similar legislation. I don't know as it's on, but have established it so you can co-use part of the base. I don't think the military base nor the commander would want to come under the legislation of a military effectiveness zone, but the military effectiveness zone can help companies lease hangar space, even get agreements for runways, maybe to run a power plant or something else. So it's not intended to try to be inside those zones. It's trying to be close to those zones with the intent being in the zones, close to the zones, and Deputy Commissioner McHugh can answer that. There is truly a strategic location and nature to this state. I think what we're finding out is a strategic location alone does not guarantee that you're going to have, when budgets push come to shove, that your budgets will be maintained. It's sort of, I remember at a certain point in school where not only you had to be smart, you really had to work hard too. I won't tell you which category I fell in, maybe neither. But we have a strategic location, but if we don't work really hard, we'll just be viewed as an outpost that we can journey to once in a while as we do our training or whatever, have some readiness and leave and come, you know, leave a skeleton crew. This is to get away from the skeleton crew. I don't think it's to really go establish new missions throughout the state. It's to build on the ones that we have, and then maybe we can establish others as we go forward. But this was to really try to build around what we had, but I don't know if there's anything in the legislation that precludes going out, because it will be up to the Adjutant General.
Representative Sisna.
I know. You didn't. You thought that it was not going to apply here, but at the same time, I do wonder if there isn't a way that if one were thinking very critically of the boundaries of our state, there wouldn't be. And Kodiak is obviously one of those.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Chiniac is where the site actually is, right? Pretty much.
Well,
close.
Through the chair.
10 miles from where
I'm sorry, I forget that. Through the chair, Representative. Now, it's actually on Narrow Cape, which is close. Chiniac was one of two sites, but we ended up on Narrow Cape, which is about 13 miles away.
Right. Are there not other places in the state that maybe could be thought of? Because there are a number of places around the state that have been involved with military for a long time. We've got many Fort Yukon, Fort, you know, goes on and on.
True. Through the chair, absolutely. There's nothing to preclude it, but nothing whatsoever. But with this, we're trying to get really focused to support increased missions and to protect the missions that we have. You know, we've just had the F-16s announced at the move. We, with Lockheed, had looked very closely at how we could enhance the Fort Greely area. So, as missions come up, I would say absolutely look at it. But it's to enable missions, if someone's interested, or if you hear that there are missions out there, to go try to put together a package, usually with industry, in support of a military installation, but usually with industry to bring something here, or to protect something that's here already, and to bring something here, and to keep it very focused on the military support, so that we don't get sidetracked with other things, and it's modeled after other states. Jeff Drone will be able to elaborate on that more. Did I answer your question?
I think it's an ongoing question.
through the chair, that's exactly what this legislation is for, because we do not know what opportunities will come up, but we want to be able to react with the local communities and boroughs if they do come up and opportunities arise. We do not want to have to wait for another legislative cycle to begin the process.
Further questions, Mr. Nash? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Nash. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman Thompson.
Before we go to our next testifier, I am going to read the testimony of Representative Sadler into the record. Representative Sadler is co-chair of Military and Veterans Affairs and a co-sponsor on House Bill 316. So here it is. To co-chair Thompson and members of the MLV committee, though I can't be there today, I want to put on the record my strong support of House Bill 316, Military Facility Zones. I was pleased to work on this legislation during the interim with Representative Thompson and Feige, and to see it become before our committee. I see House Bill 316 as an important legislative tool to strengthen the position of military facilities in our state. Alaska has 32 different military installations that are critical elements in our state economy. There are more than 24,000 active duty guard and reserve troops serving in Alaska with an annual payroll of more than $1.5 billion. About 13% of the state economy depends on the military, with the impact being especially significant near the larger installations. These bases are a significant part of our nation's defense structure. They defend the nation's airspace and outer space, rapidly deploy forces around the world in times of crisis, support global logistics and transportation functions, and provide training opportunities that are unmatched elsewhere in the world. We've heard in recent news that does not bode well for Alaska military bases. We've heard news of nearly $500 billion in defense budget cuts over the next 10 years. We've you've heard of the possible loss of F-16s from Allison Air Force Base and the HC-130s from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. We've heard that nearly 270 civilian jobs are being cut from those two bases. And we've heard the Secretary of Defense raise the prospect of another round of base realignments and closure, BRAC process, that could mean the further diminution of the military presence in Alaska. House Bill 316 can provide a number of significant benefits to our state and nation. It will provide a mechanism for the bringing new federal and state money to bear on the bases. It will help develop infrastructure that can improve living conditions and economic prospects for the communities surrounding military facilities. It will help Alaska bases become more efficient and better able to effectively perform their missions, strengthening the case against their realignment or closure. It will provide a mechanism to fund expansion of existing facilities to embrace new missions. It will help protect private and public sector jobs. And it will provide another positive demonstration of Alaska's support for the military. I'm proud to be a co-sponsor of this legislation. Please join me in supporting its passage. Dan, Representative Dan Sadler, co-chair of the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee. And I put that on the record. And next we will have Deputy... where are we at here? Deputy Commissioner of the Military and Veterans Affairs, Mr. McHugh Pierre. Please put yourself on the record.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for your time. I'll be brief. McHugh Pierre, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. There were a couple questions asked. One that needs to be understood here is that the community will apply for this zone, and they will designate the size of the zone up to an area of 500 square miles. So it could overlap an existing military facility, but it doesn't have any impact on existing businesses or any other activity that's already happening. It simply says that the community wants to develop that area that is near the military facility with partners such as Lockheed Martin, who is on the line, Jeff Trone, who are direct contractors with DOD. And so it doesn't, I know other people have talked about, well, what about payday lenders? Do they get to take advantage of this? Absolutely not. People working with members in the military are not able to take advantage of this legislation, only direct contractors to DOD. So if you had a company in Fairbanks and the borough wanted to apply to create a zone, it could be near Eielson, it could be near Wainwright, and a company in Fairbanks contracts directly with DOD, they would be able to take advantage of this. And the advantages are development opportunities where AHFC and ADA have said they will work with these companies to provide opportunities for low-interest loans and other stuff to build the community in the way the community wants to be developed, but also benefiting directly working with the military installation and helping to lower some of those costs, which could mean operating some of those buildings on the installation. We think this is critical to make sure that we diversify the users of the military installations, because the number one thing we've heard from the 2005 BRAC hearing was the cost to operate military installations in Alaska is high. Well, if we can help offset those costs directly to DOT by having other users in there, that would be a benefit that would allow us to maintain our current missions, expand to new missions, and build the economy at the same time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Sisson has a question.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And my question is one that grows out of having spent some time in Galena at the now Galena is owned by I think it's owned by the local community, and so are all the facilities. And some of the people that are there in the school that's on the base have had different ideas, like turning the parts of the field into places where they could grow willow, for instance, that grow up every year. Every year it's going to grow up maybe 10 feet. And could be cut down at the end of the season. Isn't going to be really a problem. You could mow those down and have a base there again really easily, and do kind of the biomass idea in the renewable energy, And that's been one of the things they had toyed around with. Would this fit into that kind of thing at all?
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, it would not. That would be a separate economic development project that the city of Galena would have to work through Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. This would only be for an existing active military installation to establish that zone. So, you know, the company wouldn't be working directly with DOD in that situation, the scenario that you provided.
Go ahead, Representative Sisna.
Thank you. Now, on at Greeley, are they active? Are they actively working? Okay, because I know there are partnerships between the community and that on that base, and I'm just trying to think of examples where, in fact, this would work and be able to have it be two win-win situations where you can actually be expanding on both sides.
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, Fort Greeley is a great example. Any community that has existing military infrastructure is an example that you could use. You know, Unalaska, King Salmon, all of these places, Nome, you know, Sitka. So we see this as a wide a tool that can be cast far out over any community that has a military facility and hopefully entice future development as well.
Okay. Thank you.
We heard in our last resolution about the Coast Guard. We're talking about trying to get a Coast Guard base further, closer to the Arctic. This type of thing could be utilized to maybe enhance that project or bring it online.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, and we appreciate your support and all the work that you and your staff put into this. You specifically made sure that we had the Coast Guard piece in there because they are a key part of the military presence in our state, even though they're not in the DOD budget, they're in DHS, but they are a military asset, and we intend to partner with them as much as possible.
Further questions from the committee? Mr. Pierre, I thank you very much for your testimony. And next we're going to go to online. Jeff Trone, calling in from Washington, D.C. Mr. Trone, are you there?
I did log it in.
Sorry, I had to do it.
Yes, I can. Go ahead and place yourself on the record and we'll hear your testimony.
I'm Jeff Chung. My title is Vice President, Economic Development for Lockheed Martin Corporation. I've been with Lockheed Martin just about 30 years and I grew up on the Cape, so people say I have 50 years in aerospace, but I've spent the last 15 years in economic development deals for Lockheed Martin. We do them in general to drive our price down to the military customer doing the work, and in general let's serve the military too because it lowers the cost.
Just slow down just a little bit so we can pick it up. It's, thank you.
I have spent 30 years with Lockheed Martin, 15 of which were in economic development. I generally spend my time doing economic development agreements with state and localities with Lockheed Martin to lower our overall cost of doing business. And we pass that savings on to the military. So basically it works for all parties. The idea is to generate an optimum business climate that supports the military mission that lowers the cost of goods and services to the resulting military base. And I think these types of zones serve well to enhance those relationships. Now there were two questions I thought I'd address. One was how the zones shaped in other states. You're probably all familiar with town planning. Generally, the zones follow town planning for what they want to do. So normally, you see the zone out the main gate of the military base in the surrounding area where an industrial park would be to facilitate munitions. So you have a base commander who, as a result of BRAC, would love to get an electronic warfare mission, for example, but he has no facilities to perform it. So the zone authority sits down with the contractor likely to win it, or teams of contractors trying to win it, and establishes the infrastructure, the buildings that are necessary to do the electronic warfare mission on the base. And the infrastructure is shared by military personnel and contracted personnel supporting the base. I have seen zones on the base. The general way that is done is to use some other legislation. It's called enhanced use leasing or modified enhanced use leasing, where the base commander segregates a portion of the base that he's not using, leases it to a private entity or a public entity, a public economic development group, for example, and then that area of the base is redeveloped to support new missions on the base, but with private private capital and public capital rather than limited MILCON funds, the military construction funds, if you're familiar with those. A good example would be Stockton Air Force Base in Ogden, Utah. The base commander determined he was only using about a third of his facilities and they were in terrible condition, and the fact that he had to maintain the whole base was running down everything because he didn't have enough money to maintain it. So he went and flattened the southern portion of the base and the northern portion of the base, and then got the MILCON funds to build new facilities on the central portion of the base, and now his annual budget for maintenance only serves about a third of the property that it did before. And he is working with the state of Utah and some local authorities to market both the southern portion of the base and the northern portion of the base for contractor development to support new missions of Falcon. And it's interesting, when you get the mission to let out, the deal is you have to locate on one of the industrial parks if you want to do business on the base. Any follow-up questions for us?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Trillin. Is there any questions from the committee? Mr. Trillin, I think you're reading that. If you could get that to my committee aide, I'll have her get a hold of you, and you can fax it to us. We'll get it put onto the record also. I'd appreciate that. Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, we have several people that have signed up that said that they are here to answer questions only. We have Stacy Schubert, who is the Director of Government Relations for Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. We have Carl Bowling and Eric Havelock, both with AHFC, that are here to answer questions if the committee has any either. Is there anybody else here in the audience or online that would like to testify? Mr. Nash, you wanted to answer somebody's question, I can tell.
One answer to a question, because it was probably not satisfactory, through the chair, Representative Cisna. One thing that you had mentioned, the biofuel, you may not, this would not specifically address Galena, but this legislation could be set up to enable biofuel, which the DOD is very interested in an area near one of the bases. So, while it may not be in an area that's been turned over to the state, what you mentioned is a very valid candidate that this bill could enable, is biofuel at the locations or other projects like that. So it may not be in the remote parts of the state, but it certainly could promote industries that we could be in a very good position to bring to help reduce the overall cost and increase the mission for the military and the presence in the state.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I even got the impression that, let's say, 35, 40 miles away, there was a gas line, and Eielson was needing natural gas. It would lower their costs, and a private company wanted to build that line. They could utilize this military facilities loan to finance that line.
That would
lower the price and the cost of running that particular base. Is that right?
Chairman, that would be a perfect candidate, because you can talk to the DOD and they will tell you that their cost of energy and heating on that base is one of the largest costs they have. So if you could drive that down, it just makes that much more feasible for the military and for the state.
Yes, Representative Sisna has one more question for you, Mr. Nash.
Thank you, and just trying to figure out exactly what the parameters are around that. Part of my thinking is that throughout Alaska's rural areas, we don't have enough jobs, actually, for people. And oftentimes, the renewable energy jobs are developing renewable energy, and renewable energy can be extraordinarily efficient and cost-effective and sustainable. And that's one way to make sure that these military zones are there for the long term, and I believe we need to have them be there for the long term, and it gives local people jobs, which, you know, makes a win-win.
No disagreement.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nash. Anybody else in the audience or online like to testify? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. We're back with this before the committee.
Question, discussion, and a motion.
Any further discussions first? Representative Miller.
Thank you. I would like to ask just a clarifying question. Again, it's the fact that I'm not familiar with exactly how a military zone operates. Within that zone, once it's established, are there any differences in how law enforcement behaves there? Is there any jurisdictional question? Fire and rescue, taxes, are all of these still governed under the same boundaries? Let's just say it's in the North Star Borough. Are all of those still the same, or is there some change in the complexion because this section has this designation?
It basically, you're not changing anything on the military base. If they are leasing land, just like the 801 housing is now Birchwood Estates, that used to be inside the Fort Wainwright. It's now inside on Fort Wainwright's property, but it is now under the property tax of the borough and the city. I mean, those type of things still are the same. It wouldn't change any of that. Okay. Law enforcement is still, if you're on the military base, you have the MPs. If you're off, it's the state police and the local police that takes care of them. So that wouldn't change.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Further discussion? Seeing none, do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill number 316, 27-LS1191/1 with zero fiscal note and individual comments.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, then we've advanced House Bill 316 from committee. Don't leave, everybody. We are going to have to sign this. This concludes our business for this committee hearing, and our next Military and Veterans Affairs Committee meeting is not yet scheduled. We're waiting to get to see what we have lined up to come forward, and we'll let the members know as soon as possible. And at exactly 2:29 p.m., this committee is adjourned.